We'll move to the third case this morning. Freed versus J.P. Morgan Chase. Case number 13-23-39. All right, Mr. Goodman.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm David Goodman. I represent Eric D. Freed. With me at tables Mr. Spathis, George Spathis, and Thadford Felton. This is an appeal from the lower court's decision abstaining in two cases, Freed versus J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, the Chase case, and Freed versus Paul Weiss, Ronald Weiss, and Complex Litigation Group, which we refer to in our briefs as the distributional interest lawsuit.
That's the main litigation.
It is the main litigation. Well, it's the main litigation, and it is the piece of the litigation that makes it absolutely clear, beyond a doubt, that the claims in the state court and the federal courts are not parallel. In the distributional interest lawsuit, after Mr. Freed dissociated, Mr. Freed exercised his statutory right to seek a determination, to compel judicial determination compelling the limited liability company to purchase his distributional interest. And under the Illinois Limited Liability Company Act, he and he alone had standing to commence that proceeding. And once he commenced that proceeding, assuming that there was jurisdiction, and there was, vested the district court, which is where he presented his claim. It was the only place the claim was presented. It vested the district court with exclusive jurisdiction and plenary jurisdiction over the issue. That in itself should be clear, make it clear that there cannot, as a matter of law, be any parallel state proceeding because the district court had exclusive jurisdiction. And as the court made clear in TrueServe and in many other cases, any doubt regarding the parallel nature of cases of proceedings must be resolved in favor of the federal court exercising its jurisdiction. In this instance, where the district court, through Mr. Freed's commencement of a proceeding, vested the district court with exclusive and full jurisdiction, there could not be. And there had never been, but there could not be a parallel proceeding. Consequently, the court erred.
Dissociation was critical in the state court. I mean, that's a critical fact on which the state court claims that remain pivot, as I understand.
The issue of dissociation in and of itself is simply a trigger for the obligation for the LLC to purchase the interest. So where and when, how the dissociation occurred in and of itself is only a trigger. Mr. Freed cannot commence a proceeding until he has dissociated. The dissociated member can only commence a proceeding to compel the limited liability company to purchase upon dissociation. So regardless of the outcome of the state proceeding, regardless of when he dissociated or how he dissociated, that would be the end point, really, in the state proceeding altogether. It's the state proceeding. When Mr. Freed commenced the state proceeding initially, he commenced an action to protect his rights as a member of the limited liability company. When he decided that he was no longer going to pursue the enforcement and the protection of his rights, he was going to exercise his statutory right to dissociate, which he did. That commenced and gave rise to a new bundle of rights. So whether or not Mr. Weiss could show somehow, under some circumstance, that Mr. Freed had dissociated earlier would not in any way impact Mr. Freed's right, other than to the extent that it would give rise to his ability and right to commence the proceeding, which is what he did. Now, there are other additional reasons to find that the distributional interest lawsuit and the Chase lawsuit are not parallel to the federal act, to the state proceeding. Among other things, in the distributional interest lawsuit, Mr. Fried is pursuing claims against his personal accountant, Ronald Weiss, for actions that Mr. Ronald Weiss undertook as his accountant. These claims are not derivative, would not be determined by the outcome of the state proceeding. They have to do with financial reporting, things that Mr. Ronald Weiss was obligated as Mr. Fried's accountant to do on his behalf. To the extent that Ronald Weiss provided, and these are outlined in paragraph 50 of some of these things, at least, are outlined in paragraph 50 of Mr. Fried's distributional interest lawsuit against Ronald Weiss. Again, these are not claims that are pending in the state case. And in fact, if the state court was to find somehow that Paul Weiss hadn't breached duties, that would not be dispositive of Mr. Fried's claims against his accountant as his accountant, which is what's at issue in, again, the distributional interest lawsuit in count six. Again, not parallel. The claims against Chase are also not parallel. We talk about, and I've said, regardless of the outcome, if the court was to find that Mr. Fried dissociated back in March of and the state court was to find that Mr. Fried dissociated back in March of 2011, aside from the fact that to do that it would have to ignore filings by the limited liability company.
That's a merits question.
I understand that, but again,
the claims are basically the inverse of each other, or the lawsuits are the inverse of each other. They're just, we've got different theories pleaded, different causes of action pleaded, but the claims are basically the inverse of one another.
Well, they really aren't. The distributional interest lawsuit really isn't. There are common facts that are discussed in the distributional interest lawsuit, no question about that. But we're talking about different facts and different rights at different times in the distributional interest lawsuit. Upon dissociation, different rights come into being that were not at issue in the state case, ever. In fact, what happened, interestingly, in August of 2012, in the motion that has been submitted for the court to take judicial notice of other proceedings to try to illustrate the course of proceedings, in August of 2012, after Mr. Fried dissociated, counsel for the limited liability company, and this is in SA 183 and 184 of what they have submitted for the court to take notice of, counsel told the state court, after showing the court the lawsuit that was filed, she said that she would they could go ahead and simply file a declaratory judgment complaint in the state court, effectively trying to mirror what had been filed. That in itself should be a tacit concession, recognition that what had been submitted wasn't actually pending in the court. It's also a very, very obvious attempt to try to manufacture the appearance of parallelism where parallelism doesn't exist. Again, this isn't something that they've submitted. It's an SA 183 of their...
I think there's plenty of jurisdictional maneuvering going on here, so casting aspersions on your opponent in that fashion is going to invite some of that in return.
Well, I'm saying it's what they've submitted. It's in the record. It's what she says. It's SA 183. It's plainly what it says.
Everyone's maneuvering for tactical and strategic advantage here, to avoid the preclusive effect of one court's ruling on the other. This is a case that's tailor-made for Colorado River abstention. We don't want jurisdictional competition.
Well, actually, it's not, because particularly in this case, where you've got different claims, rights.
This is the scenario. You filed in state court, got hit with some counterclaims, didn't like how that litigation was going, filed in federal court. And so there's all this maneuvering going on, and this is exactly what Colorado River abstention is designed to avoid, this kind of advantage taking.
Actually, to give up, in order to bring suit in federal court, Mr. Fried had to actually concede rights. He had to give up his rights as a member and manager of the limited liability company. He had to give up that set of rights So he gave up claims that he had, and he gave up rights that he had, and he gave those up. And all he was seeking and is seeking in the federal distributional interest lawsuit is that the LLC meet its statutory obligation. These are, again, claims that were never asserted and cannot be asserted in the state court, and were not until Mr. Fried dissociated and sought to enforce his rights, to cause the LLC to purchase his interest as it was obligated to do. It didn't do that. It's, again, different claims, different bundle of rights altogether. And he chose and was entitled to choose to bring his action in the district court because there was diversity. To require for the court to suggest that he actually, what he was required to do was to bring it in the state court would be to sort of to go back from the court's decision in TrueServe, which is to suggest that he somehow has, that you would find parallelism based on the notion that there's some sort of compulsory counterclaim. And again, that's been squarely rejected. It was rejected in TrueServe. And furthermore, in the court's decision in the Huon case, talking about the idea and notion of res judicata, the court made it very clear that there's a distinct difference between parallelism and res judicata and res judicata effect.
Will all the counterclaims go forward in the state court?
Well, that's a great question.
I'm just wondering if this is, you're trying to say that you shifted a whole lot, or shifted or started anew in federal court, but there's current litigation in the state court, which is going to involve an awful lot. Now, is the state court then supposed to say, well, we'll just wait and see what they do in the federal court?
No. In fact, first off, to suggest that the state court has proceeded at all is to sort of ignore what's actually transpired in the state court. The court, after granting Mr. Fried's motion, finding that it, among other things, could not expel him, ordered that they file, gave them leave, actually, to file an amended counterclaim. They filed that. They sought to file it, and they filed it the day after our reply brief in this court was due. What they did in that was exactly what counsel promised back in August of 2012. What they did was they filed a declaratory action that purported to mirror Mr. Fried's claims to try to create the appearance, to manufacture the appearance of parallelism. They don't have standing, among other things. We're not even at issue in the state court. So the answer is, will they proceed? I suspect that there'll be motion practice that will identify and be directed at the defective pleadings that they have filed. But in any event, Mr. Fried should not be precluded from proceeding with his claims, which weren't parallel, which were filed compliant with the law of the land, where Congress has vested the district court with diversity jurisdiction. He brought his claim when it became a real claim, when he dissociated. He brought it in the court that had jurisdiction, and unfortunately that court failed to exercise its jurisdiction, and in doing so it violated violated its obligation and his interest. I still light's on, so I'd like to reserve time for rebuttal.
That's fine. Who's first? Mr. Leon?
Yes. May it please the court, my name is Jeff Leon. I'm representing Complex Litigation Group and the other defendants on that particular complaint. I would respectfully suggest that Mr. Goodman lost his argument almost the minute he mentioned Mr. Fried's purported dissociation in August of 2012. Everything he said was predicated, and I'm quoting, after Mr. Fried dissociated. And he says a whole bundle of different rights and obligations comes into play. That is the very disputed issue that is going on in the state court. Mr. Fried's position is almost a metaphysical one in the sense of how many times can you quit the same law firm? Because that is what is being litigated in the state court. This case all started when an arbitration was filed in 2011 saying that Mr. Fried had quit through a particular contractual provision of the LLC called voluntary termination. As of March 2011, that issue is being litigated in the state court. That is part of the counterclaims. That has always been a part of the case. This is a most unusual case in that the district court has to divine the circuit court's intention with regard to what is or what is not before the circuit court, usually all by themselves. But here,
at the very least, it has to do with the determination of what duties were owed to one another and the damages measure, if nothing else.
Right. And the issue of voluntary termination under my client's reading of this contract, which is the ultimate merits issue, is there is no right to a purchase of distributional interest if Mr. Fried, in fact, withheld his services as that clause of the contract envisions. The only remedy he has is contractual. And there's law, we put this in our brief, and it is a merits question, that the contract can trump the LLC Act. Now, Mr. Goodman's view is that his client gets a purchase of a distributional interest no matter when he quits, no matter under what circumstances his quitting arose. We believe that's not true. That's the issue that's being litigated. And this case is just like Day versus Union Mines, where this court evaluated a variety of arguments that there were differences and in a shareholder case. And what the court said was the shareholder's federal litigation seeking an interpretation of the payment provision was premature. That question will arise only after an ultimate determination that the contract is valid and the shareholders are entitled to relief. The question of whether an amount of Mr. Fried's distributional interest in the entire proceeding under Section 35/60 of the LLC Act can only arise at all if the circuit court decides that Mr. Fried was not voluntarily terminated pursuant to the contract and that the contract would not permit Mr. Fried to also receive a distributional interest. And then you get into another problem, one that Mr. Goodman has glossed over entirely, which is Mr. Fried claims he quit the law firm dissociation on August 21st, 2012. That is the only claim in the federal complaint. August 21st, 2012, period. Now, the circuit court has before it and has had before it for a year and a half claims, declarations that Mr. Fried had constructively dissociated through misbehavior and of various dates, beginning in March of 2011 and also in January, February, and March of 2012. Now, if the circuit court decides that Mr. Fried, in fact, did dissociate, then Mr. Fried cannot have a claim in federal court that he quit by writing the letter that he wrote on August 21st, 2012. If he quit in February 2012, he cannot get a distributional interest valued as of the date, the only date, that's in his federal complaint, which is August 21st. And, again, I want to quote the circuit court here, because the circuit court is the one who's been, who's been as you noted, Judge Sykes, there's been a lot of maneuvering going on. And the circuit court is the one, Judge Pantley, who's been overseeing all of it. As she said, and this is in her order dated September 25th, 2013, we submitted this, she said, the date of plaintiff's dissociation is important because the court's decision as to that date will affect any sums of money which may or may not be due plaintiff. Determining the date of plaintiff's dissociation also affects other rights and remedies claimed by the counterplaintiffs, which are my clients. Plaintiffs is not entitled to short-circuit the determination of when he dissociated from the LLC by unilaterally dictating that his date of dissociation was August 21st, 2012. That's precisely what he's trying to do. He's trying to say, well, my client admits he was dissociated by August 21st, 2012. So all this other stuff flows from it, when in fact the issue in the state court is that he didn't. That letter was a superfluous act, a self-serving, aggrandizing act by somebody who was trying to get away from the state court. And he thought, I can do this. But the reality is the state court has always been litigating the question of whether he quit long before that. And the only bundle of rights he's seeking in the federal court flow from that one date, that one letter on that one date, August 21st, 2012. And Judge Sykes, you noted the jurisdictional maneuvering, but there is an element of the jurisdictional maneuvering that you didn't even mention, nor did they, and I think it's worth bringing up. We brought up in our brief, and they didn't even address it in their reply. I challenge you to find a word about it in the reply. They filed a motion to compel arbitration after losing a series of interlocutory appeals to the appellate court and a bunch of motions at the state court. They reversed field. They had resisted arbitration, had refused to pay the fee with the AAA, and suddenly, 6 months into litigation in the state court, they said, you know what, we want to compel arbitration. Judge Pantley ruled that they had waived it, and they appealed that a year ago. They appealed it before they filed the federal lawsuit. They appealed it. And then the day that Mr. Freed sent in his letter claiming that was the day he was quitting, they filed a case in federal court containing claims that they admit on the face of the complaint would be subject to the very arbitration they're attempting to compel. And they're resisting a stay while they're trying to get a stay in the state court compelling arbitration? That issue alone is parallel and justifies Colorado River abstention. But it shows the lengths, because they're not just trying to ping pong between two courts, they're actually trying to juggle three. They've got the AAA, the circuit court, and the federal courts all competing for jurisdiction. And the competition for jurisdiction, Your Honor, I submit has been extraordinary.
I think none of us want this case.
Right. Well, believe me, my clients don't, nor do I, having had to live through much of this on a real-time basis. But the, you know, some aspersions were cast, as you noted, and complaining as to the state of the circuit court. The level of foot dragging that's suddenly gone on. I mean, Mr. Freed's been pulled to the point where he's about down to his knees in the mud. He doesn't want to move. We have tried to get a protective order entered for a year and a half. Finally, Judge Pantley did it. There's documents that are finally starting to flow. Mr. Freed is the one who had to change lawyers four times and all of the delay that that engendered. And these little departures down, you know, diversion lane from having to move to compel arbitration and what that did to the case, they're all layable at the feet of Mr. Freed. This case probably would have gone to trial already, but Judge Pantley said on the record that this case, in her view, will be set for a trial in the spring of 2014. This case will get resolved. The issues are parallel. It's inescapable. This plenary and exclusive argument, that's something else that they didn't address in their reply. They pretended like we didn't address it. But we had some very specific arguments about this language, and I want to direct the court to those. The first argument that we made is that we pointed out that they're misconstruing the purpose of this language. It's not to say that a federal court, if you sue first there for a distributional interest, has the only jurisdiction over determining the issue of whether or not you get a distributional interest. Rather, it's a recognition of the reality that Illinois has no compulsory counterclaim law. So, if under the statute, Mr. Freed would give notice that he is starting a distributional interest lawsuit, any other member of the firm could, absent that plenary and exclusive language, file a lawsuit in any other county in Illinois in which they happen to reside, which would create a competition within Illinois. That's what that language is about. It's not about the abuse that Mr. Freed is putting that language to. No response in the reply. None whatsoever. We respectfully submit that Your Honor was correct, that this case is the prototypical example screaming out for abstention under Colorado River. I defer the remainder of Appley's time to my co-counsel. Or not my co-counsel, but
this
counsel,
the bank's counsel. Chase. Right. Mr. Furek?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Farrick on behalf of the appellee J.P. Morgan Chase in case number 132339. With me is Paul Fox, who's sitting at the table. We ask this court to affirm the district court's decision abstaining on Colorado River grounds and staying the case until the resolution of this state court proceeding. We agree with the court entirely that this is a case that is tailor-made for Colorado River abstention. At its most basic level, from what we've just heard and from what the papers, the pleadings below make apparent, and as well as the district court's painstaking review of the dockets and the pleadings, this is a law firm business divorce. It was commenced by Mr. Freed in the Illinois state court system. It's going forward in the Illinois state court system, and it will be decided in the Illinois state court system. All of these issues that we're hearing about, all of these different actions that we're hearing about, and frankly, I hear more about new ones and more about them, the arbitrations that are going on and everything else, it's all going to come down to the factual predicate, the core set of facts, the common thrust, all of this language that appears in the Seventh Circuit's decisions regarding Colorado River abstention. All of those issues are going to be decided in the state court action that was initially commenced by Mr. Freed. Briefly, with respect to the abstention analysis and with respect to J.P. Morgan Chase, the parallelism is very straightforward in this case. Counsel for Mr. Freed will claim in very conclusory terms that there's no parallelism, but the one thing that's missing, both in the briefs as well as the argument you just heard, is any explanation how parallelism could possibly not exist in this case. J.P. Morgan held two bank accounts for the LLC in December of 2011. One was an IALTA account, another was a corporate account. The claims against J.P. Morgan are that when Mr. Weiss withdrew funds from those LLC accounts, that he breached his... The claim is that Mr. Weiss breached his fiduciary duties and he breached the operating agreement. The claims against Chase in the federal action are that Chase aided and abetted that breach of fiduciary duty and also tortiously interfered with the LLC's operating agreement. Fundamentally, any liability that Chase could possibly have is dependent upon the actions that were taken by Mr. Weiss, which have always been front and center before the state court.
Which is to say, if there's no breach of contract or no breach of fiduciary duty, there's no derivative liability on the part of the bank.
That's exactly right. And that very issue has always been front and center before Judge Pantley and the state court. In that sense, this case is very similar to Clark versus Lacey, it's similar to Lumen versus Brandt, where you have a common issue, a common theme, a common set of predicate acts that are before the state court that the federal action will ultimately depend upon, which is really set forth in the decision by the district court on page 16, pretty much verbatim, Judge Sykes saying exactly what you just said. So we have a situation here where the state court can dispose of the federal action. Res judicata will undoubtedly apply based on those rulings, and there will not be, depending on the resolution of that case, it's substantially likely, virtually certain, that there won't be a case remaining against Chase. With respect to the 10-factor test, this court has the benefit of a 25-page decision that painstakingly went through all of this. It's the type of abstention decision from the district court that this court comments on favorably, going through everything, taking everything into consideration, and going into great detail. The drivers of the district court's decision, avoidance of piecemeal litigation, the vexatious nature of these cases, and the need to avoid further gamesmanship and the risk of inconsistent rulings, we've been talking about it. The court has commented on it. It's virtually certain to occur here if these actions were both allowed to go forward. It needs to be stopped, and that's the reason why the district court entered the order abstaining that it did. The consideration of the factors is entitled to deference. The weight that's given by the district court to the various factors is entitled to deference. And in this situation here, we believe that the district court did properly analyze all of the factors, and the decision should be affirmed in its entirety, and the cases should be abstained pending resolution of the state proceeding.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Goodman, you've got 2 minutes left.
What's clear is that regardless of what happens in the state court, if the court finds that Mr. Freed dissociated in March or if the court of 2011 or if it finds that he dissociated in August of 2012, assuming that those are actually even before the court, it doesn't matter because dissociation in and of itself is the trigger point. It starts and gives rise to a new bundle of rights. It gives rise to the dissociated member's right to compel the purchase. It doesn't exist until he's dissociated. So to the extent that the district court makes a finding that Mr. Freed dissociated in March of 2011 or in August of 2012, all that means is that's the starting point. If the LLC was to show that Mr. Freed somehow voluntarily terminated, that would be an act of dissociation, a 3545-2 act of dissociation. Again, that's a trigger of the LLC's obligation to purchase. Only the dissociated member can commence an action under the statute. It's very clear. It talks about dissociated member can bring an action to compel the purchase. Mr. Freed did that, and he did that in the federal court, vesting that court with exclusive jurisdiction. Where that happens, there cannot be a parallel case. Consequently, the Colorado River analysis is inapplicable.
It's not exclusive. That claim could have been filed in the state suit.
But where the court's in the court, it defines the act itself defines court as any court with jurisdiction, any judge's jurisdictions. He commenced that action. He chose, and he had a right to commence that.
Subject to abstention doctrines and other rules of federal civil procedure.
But in terms of a diversity plaintiff's right, he has a right to bring an action, and he commenced an action.
Subject to abstention, if there's a parallel proceeding in state court.
Well, but again, they've conceded, and if you look at SA 183 and 184, what they've actually asked the court to take judicial notice of, it's clear that there was an acknowledgement that they hadn't commenced an action for this, nor could they have commenced an action for this. And Mr. Freed, in the state court, had only been seeking to enforce his rights as a member. When he gave those up, when he dissociated, that gave rise to the right to commence an action, which he did. And consequently, we believe that it was entirely inappropriate. The court erred in even considering Colorado River because the cases weren't parallel, and the case should be remanded. Both cases should be remanded.
Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.